I called the police on my abuser after he strangled me in front of our children. And the first thing that happened is that they arrested me. Hi, I'm Zonva Lyons, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. This short, haunting vignette hints at our subject today, which is how the carceral system is weaponized against abuse survivors, and especially against women who defend themselves against abuse. The vignette reflects what the data tell us. Several studies have shown that when regions pass mandatory arrest policies requiring someone to be arrested during a domestic violence call, the number of victims arrested skyrockets. Before we get into today's topic, a few administrative updates. First, storytelling is critical to the success of this podcast. If you would like to share a story of abuse, misogyny, motherhood, or anything else you think might be relevant to the podcast, you can share a vignette that might be read in a future episode. To learn how to do so and to access a wide range of other podcast resources and information about my work, visit liberatingmotherhood.org. Second, as anyone existing as a woman on social media or frankly in the world knows, women are under attack online. Social media platforms ban feminist creators for merely existing, fail to promote our work, and make it difficult to build or sustain large audiences. We must push back by aggressively staying where we are not wanted, steadily colonizing these spaces for feminist and anti-racist work. One of the most important ways we can do this is by giving social media algorithms the engagement they want. How do we do that? Engaging with feminist content. You can help this podcast succeed and continue to exist by leaving a positive review online, by like reacting and sharing it, and by commenting on the podcast. Commenting is also a great way to have a discussion with me and with other listeners, so be sure to leave a comment on Substack. And if you really love this work, you can support it financially. Paid subscribers get a bonus podcast episode each month, free merch, access to a support group, and at least 8 extra essays per month. Sign up at zon.substack.com. You can find all the books I mentioned on the podcast at the Liberating Motherhood Bookshop page, which also hosts tons of book recommendations and reading lists. Visit the page at bookshop.org/shop/liberatingmotherhood. As always, however you found me, thanks for being here. I am so excited to welcome today's guest, Justine Vanderloon, who will be talking about her new book, Unreasonable Women: Three Stories of Violence, Imprisonment, and Extraordinary Survival. Justine, thank you so much for being here.
It is an honor.
Well, it's wonderful having you. Before we get started, I want to read your bio so listeners know a little bit more about you. Justine Vanderloon is a journalist, author, and creator, and host of the acclaimed podcast Believe Her. Her work has appeared in The New York Times, The New York Review of Books, New York Magazine, Harper's Magazine, and The Guardian. She has received fellowships from New America, the Emerson Collective, and PEN America, and more. Justine brings both deep investigative reporting and a thoughtful, engaging interview presence to conversations about violence, justice, and survival. So I'm so glad you're here, and I finished your book last night, and I really loved it. It's truly masterful storytelling, which is hard to come by. I'm hoping we could start with an overview of how you came to write the book and also what the book is about.
Well, thank you for reading it. You're one of my very earliest readers, so that's great that you had that reaction. The way I came to it, okay, quite quickly, one part that I haven't sort of mentioned when I've been talking about this book is that I actually read a report that came out, I believe it was around 2015, 2016, called The Sexual Abuse to Prison Pipeline. It was put out by Georgetown University and an organization called Human Rights for Girls. And it looked at the ways in which girls in the juvenile justice system have often been severely sexually abused before they are funneled into the system. And I thought that connection was really fascinating. I was interested in reporting on it, but it's really hard to report on children. Also, children who are in a system, so they don't have necessarily an advocate, a mother, a guardian that you can contact. So that's where I kind of like got this interest in this larger topic. And then I came to learn about criminalized survival. And that's what the book is really about. It's about, to quickly define it, criminalized survival is a phenomenon in which people, and it's really usually girls and women, act in ways to protect themselves or a loved one from abuse or assault, and are subsequently arrested, prosecuted, incarcerated for the actions they took to defend themselves or to protect themselves. So I was interested in that topic generally. And there was a case, I don't know if you've heard about this case, a lot of people have by now, that was happening in Poughkeepsie, New York at the time, and was being the group Survived and Punished, which is a group that works with criminalized survivors, was not advocating for this. They didn't have like a campaign for this particular case, but they sort of mentioned it and I heard about it. It was about a woman named Nikki Edamondo, who was from Poughkeepsie, New York, and was at the time that I came upon the case in 2018 in legal proceedings. She had killed her extremely abusive partner, that's what she said, in self-defense in 2017, I believe. And there was a lot of evidence of that. It was wending its way through the court. The county, the district attorney's office was prosecuting her for basically cold-blooded murder, going extremely hard on her. And I went up and I met some people that knew her, her sister, her friend. It couldn't be Nikki herself. I mean, I sort of saw her in the distance, but she was on house arrest. She couldn't talk to media. And the story that I was being told by the people who knew her, and the story that I was beginning to report out, had really nothing to do with what happened in the courtroom. And I'm happy to talk about more, that case more. But basically, seeing how there were two different narratives going on here, and seeing how the narrative that I believed, and not only that I believed, but that I was able to back up in my reporting, had absolutely really nothing to do with the narrative that the district attorney was spinning in court, calling this woman a master manipulator, saying she planned this, she was a killer. And then Nikki got 19 years to life. And that really got me started on this whole larger project of trying to understand how common is this? Are our prisons filled with Nikki's? What is really going on here in our legal system when it comes to women?
Yeah, it's really scary. So I had a piece a couple of years ago I wrote that be quickly became one of my most popular pieces, and I called it "Violence Against Women is Legal. We Just Pretend Otherwise." And this piece was about how, no matter what you think women need to do to document their abuse and to get help for it, in most cases, or in many cases, nothing they do works. They call the police over and over again. They seek restraining orders. Their partner's molesting their children. They get CPS involved. And no matter what, it seems like they're always blamed. And there's always some area that they come up short where they're not the perfect victim. And so, in light of that, it's kind of easy to see how women get backed into a corner where they really feel like they have no choice. And I think that that's something that people who have not been in an abusive relationship or not known someone who is in an abusive relationship really may not realize is that there isn't support for women who are being abused and leaving. And there's not an easily accessible just family court. And the fact that your partner abuses your children does not mean they'll be protected from him. So, I think you're kind of addressing what happens on the other side of this. So I would like to hear more about this case and tell listeners more about this case because I did follow it and it's enraging, but it's also interesting.
When you said violence against women is legal, that just made me think of a quote I had been looking at recently by Catherine MacKinnon. And that quote is, "The way the crime of rape is defined and what we have to prove to be believed do not fit our experience of the injury. The reality is that not only married women, but also women men know or live with can be raped at will. Men know this. Rape is not illegal, it is regulated." That's from like the 1970s, but that really made me think about it the way, yes, rape is not illegal, it's regulated. Violence against women is not illegal, it's regulated. And so Nikki's case, yes, Nikki's case, I ended up writing an article called The Evidence Against Her and then doing a podcast on this case. But basically what happened here is that she was a young mom. She had been sexually assaulted by a neighbor when she was 5, and that had never really been dealt with or acknowledged or treated. And so, even though she had the sort of outer trappings of being in this middle class community, good grades, preschool teacher, gymnastics coach. She was like a pretty wholesome person. In fact, she did not know who Prince was. I recently learned. I'm like, you didn't know who Prince was? She was just like really living in this sort of quite wholesome existence. And, but she had this trauma that I think was following her and was, you know, her ability to navigate, for many reasons, healthy relationship was compromised. So when she was, and she also, you know, she hated sex. She had been so traumatized by what happened to her that had really been taken from her, the ability to enjoy it. But of course, she understood that it was quote unquote required as an adult. So that was something she had trouble navigating. So she met this guy, I believe she was 19. I think he was 20, 21. His name was Chris. And he seemed really gentle to her. They were friends, and she was grateful that he allowed that he was patient. So they got in a relationship, and you know, it was complicated the way that these abusive relationships are. Obviously, didn't start like she once said to me. Yeah, it started with him burning me with metal spoons. I probably wouldn't have stayed, but it started normally, and then it really unraveled. And by the time that it had gotten extreme, they had a child. And Nikki was a total, like, all her life she dreamed of being a mom. She wanted to be a stay-at-home mom. She wanted to be able to be with her kids. That was her whole, I mean, I'm not like that. You know, that's not what I ever wanted. And that she just was, that was her experience of being a woman and mother, is that's what she wanted in her life. And she just wanted to be able to stay home with them and be with them every second of the day. So 6 weeks after she gave birth to her first child, her son, when she told her partner that she was pregnant, he said, okay, it's all going to be different. Just move in with me. I'm not going to hurt you anymore. And he kept that promise for the length of the pregnancy. So she was kind of lulled into thinking, okay, it's like going to be better. And when she gave birth, the doctor said, as they say to us all, no sex for 6 weeks postpartum. But as many people know, like very few people are ready 6 weeks later. And so at the 6 week mark, he said to her, all right, I want to have sex now. And she said, no. And that, you know, things just, he slammed her against a door, put her on the floor. He raped her. And thus began like the next series, the next years of abuse. So he abused her in a lot of really weird ways. Like I think that he was probably addicted to internet, like to sort of torture porn. And so he started putting her online bound with like toys, 4 hours of toys and torture tonight, like captions. And he started abusing her physically. She had a second child. She was pregnant before, like when she was trying to think of leaving. So one of the reasons that she couldn't get out of this relationship was A, she didn't feel she had anywhere to go. But B, she was really concerned that he would take these images that he had of her and paint her as a quote slut, you know, say, hey, she's a bad mom. She was afraid of, like, you know, as you were saying, the family court, she was really afraid of losing her children. So she was in this relationship. Also, people weren't noticing the violence against her, but she had started documenting the violence bit by bit, with an eye to one day getting out and being able to have some evidence to show that she had been abused and that she wasn't this, like, you know, I mean, I would never use the word slut, but that is what she was scared of. She was so scared of that, or an unfit mother. So she was. Anyways, so she had all of this evidence. Everybody in town kind of saw what was going, sort of saw, looked away, et cetera, what was going on. She was talking to one trusted friend, and they were trying to get her out of this relationship was getting worse and worse when somebody made a CPS call that said, this, we're worried about the children in the house. We're worried that they are seeing domestic violence. The CPS call, I think, made him very frightened that he was going to be exposed. So that night, after they tried to deny everything, after they smoothed over everything with CPS, he basically got out his gun, he cleaned it. It's a hazy series of events. But essentially, after the kids were asleep, he raped her. He took out the gun. They struggled over the gun. And when he said to her, she had the gun in her hand. It was his registered gun. And when he said to her, I think he said, "You're going to give that gun to me. You're not going to do anything." That's how he felt he controlled her. That's the degree. He said, "You're going to give the gun to me, and I'm going to shoot you, and I'm going to shoot myself, and then your kids will have no one." And that is when she stepped forward, shot him in the head point blank, grabbed her sleeping children, ages 2 and 5, and ran. She said it was self-defense. Immediately, the state didn't believe her, and thus began a multi-year prosecution of Nikki Adamando and her incarceration.
God, it's everything about the story just kind of follows the pattern. Abusers always have something they weaponize. They always have something they use to control you. It's usually the kids. It's just like textbook, and it's so upsetting that something can have all of the flags of textbook abuse, and then the woman is still dismissed as either crazy or evil, and usually both. I want to get to the stories in your book, but before I get to the three women who you covered, I want to talk about how you narrowed the stories down, because one of the things I found most fascinating was how many women you surveyed in advance of the book. Can you talk a little bit about that and about what you learned and saw through those surveys?
Yeah, so after I saw what happened with Nikki, I saw her get 19 years to life. I reported that story and I knew that it was just one of like a totally upside down world. I thought, okay, she is white, she is small, she's conventionally feminine. She has obeyed the rules of society as to how you're supposed to perform being a woman. And she's what, like an hour and a half from Manhattan. If this is happening to her, what all she did, she didn't die though. That was her error. That's how she erred in being a victim, right? She fought back. So I just thought, like, what happens? This is weird. Like, is this happening all the time? If it's happening to her, I started calling people and everyone's who in this space, who had been working in this space forever, said, like, yeah, of course. Our prisons are full of women like this. This is who we lock away. And then I said, okay, so where's the data? Like, how do we know? How can I just prove it? I'm going to write about it, but I just want, send me to the data. And they said, like, no, there's no data really on this. There's data on how women, we know that like up to 94% of women in prison have been abused before prison, but there's no data on women who've been imprisoned because they were abused. And that's what I wanted to know. But of course, as with Nikki, like if you looked at Nikki after, if you hadn't followed that whole case and you looked at her in a database, like the state database, you would just see a felony murder conviction, an inmate number, and a mugshot. And you would just think, oh, I guess that's that, So, of course, it's not recorded anywhere, the actual context or claims of self-defense or the life of these women. And I was talking to an attorney in Illinois named Rachel White Domain, who works on these topics. I said, how do I figure this out? This is happening everywhere. She said, well, you could just ask them. It's like, oh, that sounds great. I could just ask them, sure. How would I do that? She said, well, you just get their names and their mailing addresses from the state. You can make requests and then just write them. So at the time, it seemed reasonable. In retrospect, this was an immense undertaking, but I didn't know it at the time. Like, I just really wanted the numbers. I really wanted the numbers. So, a friend of mine who was a Yale political science professor who had helped me with some immigration articles I'd written with some data, I said to her, "Hey, Tanya, like, could you help me make a little survey to assess this?" And I went over to her apartment. It was a real grassroots effort. And we sat there for a day and we made the 16 question survey that was very broad because we didn't want to prime people. We didn't want to say, hey, are you a criminalized survivor? Hey, did you get domestically abused? Just because that can suggest to people like what I'm looking for. And particularly when we know this is a population of people that is going to be subject to so much skepticism already, just didn't want to prime. So I never mentioned abuse. I was just asking, can you tell me like about your life, about the crime of conviction, a little bit about your relationship with the person that you're convicted of killing? Why do you think that you're in prison? Those kinds of open-ended questions. And I ended up sending it to 10,000 women in prisons across America. And I ended up getting 1,000 responses, which I thread throughout the book. And I used the data that I pulled. But from those responses, I also identified three remarkable survivors and then deeply reported on their cases to kind of tell the larger story of criminalized survival through these deeply personal stories of three women: Tanisha Williams of Michigan, T.C. Brooks of California, and Gemma Heffernan of Missouri.
Yeah, so let's, okay, I want to talk about the individual women whose stories you told, and I know you probably want to hold some back because like we want listeners to actually buy the book. So please buy the book. It's told like a novel, but not in a sensationalistic or disrespectful way. And I feel like that's a challenging line to walk where you have to make their stories compelling without making them into caricatures. So you just do that really well. Can you tell us a little bit about each of the three women's stories and how they found themselves where they ended up?
Well, I appreciate you saying that, that it reads like a novel, because I was very aware that the material is like so intense and hard, and there's so much like trauma and drama going on that I was really conscious that I didn't want to make it an eat your vegetables book. I just thought, let me at least give the reader that propulsive quality, so you can so that you know there's a like a level of you can move through this. I pared down a lot. But the question is to tell you about each woman
Yeah,
a little
and
bit.
before you do, I just want to say this because like, as a reader, I think this feedback is helpful. So there's this really intense quality to the stories where it does have that propulsive quality and it does read like a novel. Again, in like a respectful, not kind of soap opera-y way, which I think, it could have gone that way. And then it sort of ends where things are different for you, but they're still kind of found where you found them. And there's this, you want something to have happened. You want some big dramatic ending. You want everything to be reversed. And that's not like really how it goes. And so you kind of walk away from the book with this intense weight of, oh, wow, this read like a novel, but this is real. And there are no like loose ends being neatly tied up.
If only there were, right? I was
Yeah.
like, can we get a tie up? But there is, a great deal of hope at the end, I
Yeah.
think, in several different ways. But there is no happy ending. There is some happy ending for some people. I'm not going to say there is no happy ending, but like the large scale issue is certainly not anywhere near solved.
Yeah, we're just like
But
I think as readers, we walk away from it with a like mandate to do something. I think it really pushes that.
that would be great. That would be amazing. I hope so. I mean, it's online. I get these feedback, which I wasn't, I'm a newbie to social media, but if there's a lot of feedback of people who want it, who do leave wanting to do something, who want to help. So, yeah. So thank you. If you want me to tell you a little bit about each woman, I'm happy to.
I
I
would love
love
for you
them.
to. Please do that.
So I would say that kind of the first woman that I report on, and the woman that I think maybe is weighted most heavily in the book, is a woman named Tanisha Williams from Saginaw, Michigan. And her story is really deeply reported in the book. I went to Saginaw, I met her in prison. We talked so much, like on maybe thousands of hours, I don't even know, hundreds for sure. And I got all of her documents. But her story is it's a wild story. The reason I was interested in her is, like, I remember getting her letter early on in the process. It was typewritten. She'd written on this typewriter that I later learned was like a prison typewriter, so it's all clear so that you can't put contraband in it. So I have this image of her with this giant Russian, or I don't know if it was manufactured there, but I feel like maybe she told me that, but this giant sort of clear typewriter that's communal that she lugged to her cell to write me. Interestingly, also, I had sent this letter out to all the women in her facility in Michigan. And I know I sent it to her, but it never got to her. She never got the letter. Like, because in prisons, things get trashed, they don't make it to people. It's very common that stuff just gets lost. But somebody else down the hall had gotten the letter because they also had a murder conviction and they didn't want to answer it. They just weren't interested. And she said, "Give me that letter. I want to answer." So it was a lot really like fortuitous, all of that. Hers is trashed, but someone mentions it and she takes it. So she fed it into the typewriter and she wrote me this letter. And she just said basically that she had taken part in a crime, but she had only done it while a gun hung over her. And that she was essentially forced to deal with the aftermath of this man's attack on another man. And that she cried and whispered, "I'm sorry," as she basically taped up this man while a gun was being pointed at her. And then she had come forward and helped the state make that case, and she was rewarded with 20 to 40 years in a maximum security facility in Michigan. So I was just like, that's a wild story, and got in touch with her right away. She called because Tanisha is like the most enthusiastic, open, sort of, I wouldn't even say bubbly person. I'm always the person in our relationship who's like more sedate, and she's like calling from a prison and she's like, "Yeah, like this is gonna be amazing." So her, her story is basically of total state failure for both her and her mother. Growing up in poverty, she was sexually abused multiple times. Like almost every man that came across this child and then young woman violated her or hurt her in some way. And ultimately, when she was 19 years old, she didn't have a home because she left from her boyfriend's mom's home, and she was basically selling drugs, not doing them, selling them. And she got sick. She didn't want to ask people to crash. She didn't have enough money for a motel, and she found a car in a field and decided to sleep there. And that was not great. And it was a summer, and she thought, "I can't do this in winter. It's a Michigan winter." So she met a guy in a bar, and he said, "Hey, I'm just getting divorced, and like I have a free room. Do you want to be roommates?" So she Sure, yeah. Like, I mean, what was her choice? Sleeping in a car or this? This seemed like a great option. Got back into being a roommate. She was a sex worker, and obviously, that's not easy when you're not housed. So she really was proud of that work because she felt, "I'm not hurting anybody and I'm making an honest day's wage." So she went back, was building back her business. But this guy that she was living with didn't like her getting successful. He wanted to own part of her. He wasn't with her, they weren't together. He just like wanted to like own her and take what she had. And so he really started abusing her really quickly. But of course, her option was a car. So she was trying to get her life together and find a way to get out safely, but also to have somewhere to land. And when she was in the midst of that, in that apartment one night, he attacked another man for reasons like no one's ever really figured out. She was literally just there. She wasn't even in the room when it happened. She came out. She screamed at the top of her lungs. He pushed her against a wall. He put a hand to her neck so hard that she felt her windpipe would crack. He put a gun to her cheek so hard that she thought the bone might break. And he was about to kill her too. I have talked to him and he says, "Yeah, like maybe." He said he doesn't really remember. He's in prison as well now. He said, "But the guy that I was then would have done that." And he absolutely says he forced her. And so he basically forced her under threat to take part in the aftermath of what he'd done, and she did. Then she came forward years later to help the police because she felt like, how can I leave this man, the victim's mother, without knowing what happened to her son? And from there, the state that had been absent all of her life and had no resources to offer her turned around with great vigor and competence and put her away.
That is a word and a sermon right there about the state refusing to help her and then immediately jumping in to put her in prison. And like when I was reading her story, the thing that stood out to me is she got pregnant for the first time via statutory rape at like 14, 13, one of those.
She had the baby at 14,
She had the baby at
but
14. Okay. And then another one at 17. And like you said, it was just the story of horrible men. And so I have to imagine to her when she first encountered this guy who offered to be her roommate, like, here's a guy just being nice to her. Like, he must have seemed like a saint after everything that she had been through. And so, of course, she just gets roped in.
I'm not even sure he seemed like a saint.
Or just like, I don't
I
know.
think he seemed like her only option.
Yeah,
And of
yeah.
course, they met in a club. It was like a cocktail club. And he was like, she remembered he was dressed all fresh and looking good. And he had all this money. And she was, struggling with all these like mental health issues at the time. Like he's in prison now, and he talked to me for hours. He had all sorts of things. He was an alcoholic. He had, I don't know if you're allowed to say alcoholic anymore, but he had a serious drinking problem. He did drugs. He was
Yeah.
in the middle of a divorce. And he was on a downward spiral. She's like sleeping in a car, but when they meet in the club, right, he's like in this fresh outfit. He's got all this cash in his hand because he was selling drugs. And he's like, hey, like you could do your hustle. Like I could do my hustle. You could help me take care of the house. I could give you let you borrow my cars. And she's like, oh, like she thought of herself as an entrepreneur. That's what she always wanted, was to build her own life for herself. She was only 19 years old. So I don't even know that she thought he was a nice guy. It wasn't a boyfriend situation. It was like, yeah, we're gonna have our thing and we're gonna live together and make it work. And she thought, great, a room, a bed, a bathroom, done.
Yeah, just it's, and it's just so sad. And like, yeah, just the way that she was completely abandoned, and the way we abandon these children in our system, and then a few years later, they bubble back up and we have so many resources. It's just, I don't even want know what to say about it, except how deeply upsetting it is.
And if she'd had, right, like just because she was estranged from her family, she never, she wouldn't have been in any of these situations if she had just had a little bit of supportive family and a home to land in at, 19 when she needed a place to go.
Well, and
That's
that's,
all
yeah.
she needed, to not be in this situation. But she didn't have that.
And she was so young. I mean,
So young.
she was 19. I mean, this is where most, privileged people are going to still be living at home, under some control of their parents. And she
Or
just
in a
had nothing.
college dorm, or in a
Yeah.
college, but she, I will also say, like, I think when you've gone through, because she had gone through so much trauma as a child, I think it also, you aren't like necessarily as, even as equipped, you're not as equipped as like your privileged kid who had all of this support and all of this guidance. I think she also never felt like she understood how to be a woman. That's what she said to me. She was always trying to figure out, how do you even navigate the world as an
Yeah.
adult, because she didn't have models. And she really, like, she had this one boyfriend who it didn't work out between them, but when she was a teenager, and she would just, his mother was a nurse, and she had a car and she had a house, and she would just sit there looking at this woman trying to figure out, like, how are you supposed to be in the world? So she was really figuring it all out on her own. She was really on her own.
But it's so sad, and it's just like the kind of person who's thinking about that stuff is the kind of person who really deserves help and can make the most of it, and we just gave her nothing. So tell me about your other two.
So Gemma is from Missouri. Gemma is kind of like criminalized survival 101, a little bit comparable to Nikki in that she essentially acted in self-defense against her abusive husband. But kind of the lead up to her crime of conviction was that, and all of the women, almost all of them that I've reported on, not just in this book, but in general, there's a pretty straight line from like childhood sexual abuse to adult domestic violence relationships to criminalized survival. So Gemma was what looked like from the outside a pretty wholesome American dream. Her dad was with the Air Force. Her mom taught preschool or was staying at home with the kids. And they had, I think, the American flag in the house in Missouri. But early on, it became clear that there were these really murky patriarchal ideas circulating in the house that were going to sort of alter Gemma's trajectory. So A bunch of things happened, but early on, she was lying in a basement in a sleepover with her brother's friend, and he put his hand down her pants, woke her up from sleep. And when she told her parents, the kid got a little bit, she felt she was in trouble. She felt she got in trouble a little bit. She felt she fell from her father's favor, that he no longer looked at her the same. And then further, the boy was made to leave the house, but he was allowed back in within a year, and nothing was ever spoken of, but she was told to go to her room whenever he would come over. So this first puts a message in her head about like her worth and what men can do and are allowed to do. And so she was really struggling with that, but there was nowhere to put that, right? Like so many girls, just these things happen to little girls, and if there isn't someone there to acknowledge it and get accountability for it, it can just keep going. So she later was, a few years later, when she was, I'm gonna again, now I'm like, was it 4, 13? I think when she was 13, she gets in a car with a local guy who's 21, and he's known for taking teenagers to go get their cigarettes and taking them to go do the things that they're not allowed to do. So she and her friend get in the car. He pulls over on the side of a road. He says to the friend, and he also has a friend, go for a walk. And his friend and her friend get out and go for a walk into the countryside. And he basically rapes her in the car. And then his friend and her friend come back, and he drives them to get cigarettes, and he drives them home. And she's just sitting there, like, what just happened? Did I just? And she says to her friend, he had sex with me. And her friend says, oh, you're a woman now, and she's thinking, did I get raped into being a woman? Like, am I a woman because of that? She tells her mom, and her mom and dad are like law-abiding, military people. They're horrified, and they go to make a claim, to bring a case. But what happens is what we see in so many cases of rape, which is that first the DA doesn't even want to take the case. They finally get a DA to take the case, and they can only get statutory rape. And obviously it was forcible rape, but they can get statutory. And I think that the guy who did it got little to no time. And also the town, because he was well known and popular, totally turned against her and her family. They harassed them. And she had to leave school. So she went into adulthood with this background of the authorities don't help, and people can do what they want to me, and there's nothing, I don't know what I don't know that I deserve anymore. She got into a bunch of abusive relationships. She had two kids. She was having issues with her family. And she was on her own when this guy that she knew through some friends came to the door, essentially came to her door and said, "Hey, can I stay?" She thought he was a friend. They had a decent like friendship. She was a single mom, so he immediately was helping her with the kids. She had one white child from her first, she's white, and her first child was white. Her second child was her the father was black. And she had felt like her family hadn't maybe fully accepted her ch black child in. And when this her new the new guy came to the door, his name was Javon. He's a black man. He really accepted her daughter with such love and compassion as his own, that she kind of like loved him immediately for that. He made himself indispensable. I think that was a genuine feeling he had for this little girl. But quickly, he became super abusive to her, and they basically had this 10-year relationship. They got married, and the abuse just went on for 10 years. But it's complicated, like all of these abusive relationships, that why she couldn't leave, how he kept coming back. And in the end, when she did finally leave him, he broke into her house. And that is undisputed. So the whole thing is so ridiculous. He broke into her house, slid into the window, lay in wait until she was alone in the home. And when she was alone in the home, he attacked her for hours. And when a gun came out and there was a struggle over it, she shot him and then she got 10 years in prison. She had a restraining order out on him at that time.
Yeah, I mean it's just unbelievable because it's just so clear self-defense, and the message there is that what was her other option? Was she just supposed to let him kill her? It seems like that's the demand of women.
Yes, she. That's what I've had. I asked about Tanisha once as an expert. I said, "So what was she supposed to do?" And she's an expert on clemency in Michigan. And she said, "Oh, to die. That was her choice." Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I would, in all of these cases, I would love to talk to the prosecuting attorney and say, like, what should she have done differently? But I'd be afraid of the answer, honestly. Like, and they don't seem like they feel like they have to justify themselves. It's so
Well, their
crazy.
story is, oh, you don't understand what happened. Like,
Yeah.
we understand it was a killing because his body was positioned in this way. Whether it was or not, they're going to say it. Oh, he was turned away. Oh, he was lying down. And because of that, it was a cold-blooded killing.
Yeah.
And even if you say like he wasn't necessarily, there's no proof of that, that maybe he was, but he also wasn't. And also, does it really matter? It doesn't matter to them.
Yeah, it seems like often the argument is like, well, she could have killed him differently or better. Or she could have, attacked him and not killed him. It's just so.
She should have let him get a little bit closer to killing her. She needed
Yeah.
there needed to be one more second closer to him killing her, and then she should have done. But it's all nonsense because no matter what, they're gonna go for her.
Yeah, and she's supposed to also know all of this in the moment and think about this in the moment.
To be an expert in the area of imminence and self-defense law, yes, this factory worker. Sex worker, preschool teacher, they are all supposed to be deeply, deeply educated about how self-defense law works.
Yeah. And also be held to a much higher standard than police who kill people, by the way.
Yes, yeah. I mean, they are absolutely right. There's what a police also. I mean, I don't want to get too far off track, but didn't people successfully use like a gay panic
Yeah.
defense, right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and police officers who like, well, I saw him holding a I thought it was a gun, was a phone, but I was in fear for my life. I mean, they're always in fear for their life.
Yeah, but women are never in fear for their lives. Okay, so tell me about your third story.
When my editor and I had we went through a lot of options for the third, I really wanted to be emblematic of a different facet of criminalized survival. And my editor and I, because we knew we had Tanisha and Gemma, another woman that was, we had a couple other women that I thought would be a good fit, but it wasn't quite working. And then we sort of sat there and said, the perfect woman, who would be the perfect? And we were laughing because we made up this hypothetical perfect third woman who would be from this coast or this coast, because we wanted, geographic diversity and would, we wanted to look at like people who kill their childhood abuser, right? Somebody who abused them in childhood. And of course, I needed the person to be what I needed these. There are many worthy cases that I could have covered. One thing special about these three women that I did cover is that they're super verbal and enthusiastic, which is really necessary when you're reporting from somebody who's living behind bars because you can't just hang out with them and report on their life. You might go to meet them a few times, but you're not going to be able to be there day to day. So you need people who are really able to talk to you and to write to you and provide you. Also, I needed a lot of documentation for these stories. And so we kind of envisioned this woman and we were like laughing about how ridiculous it is that our whole, we're making up a person who's perfect. Obviously, we're not going to get that person. And a few days later in my database, I came upon like a tagged note from a research assistant who was like, look at this woman. She's so interesting. And I look and I start reading and it was exactly what we had dreamed we would find in TC. And her story is remarkable. She was, her story is really the story of generational trauma. I think in many ways they all are, but her story like really tightly hews to that. She was, her mother was abused all her life. Her mother was in foster care. Her mother was released from foster care with a sixth grade reading level and no money at all. And so got together with several abusive men, sexually and domestic, sexually abusive, physically abusive, everything. She didn't know how to survive. She'd been given no skills and no resources. And she got together with TC's stepfather, who sexually abused TC from the time she was 4 until she was 14, violently and relentlessly. Her mother did not know about that. He also abused, she knows now. He also abused the mother, domestic violence as well as sexual violence that got worse, I think, when he sort of stopped with TC. So she had this really siloed, dysfunctional family situation. She always adored her mother, but the household was totally chaotic and bleak, and she ended up aging out, becoming an adult, trying to make a life for herself. She had not been treated for the trauma, and she never talked about what had happened to her. She was obviously living with like a lot of PTSD, but she never talked about it. But as after she left the home, her mother was more and more abused, and eventually her mother, wanted to leave this husband, didn't feel that she had the money to do it, didn't feel she had the resources. And TC, who always really thought of herself as her mother's only protector in this world, went over to confront the stepfather on a New Year's Eve in, I think it was 1989. And there was a confrontation, and she beat his head in with a metal bar a lot. And the authorities didn't believe her. I mean, they had denied it. Like, nobody could find who did it, but she ended up getting caught. They believed that she and her mother had plotted this out or what have you. And she ended up getting, I think she ended up getting life in California. And none of the abuse was ever brought out. And they were totally painted as these women who did it all for the money. And the money was really just not much. And he was painted as this lovely old retired man who just loved just being quiet and gardening, and why would this ever happen to him?
Yeah, I mean, isn't it interesting how women victims are always crazy and manipulative and conniving? And like, what did she do to cause this? And men who commit egregious acts of violence are always painted as like completely undeserving victims. It's the stories we tell about men and women are just so radically different.
And they like don't even believe, I don't even think they believe these stories. They
Yeah.
with Nikki's case, they like found a picture of her abuser in a tutu, because he was joking around wearing a tutu, and they put that at the trial so much,
Oh
like
my
this
God.
goofy guy. But they also had the pictures of her bound, bruised, screenshotted from Pornhub, and they
Yeah.
were like, she was maybe like into kink. So even how does that even work? So he's in his little tutu, but he's, and then we erase the fact that, like, if you believe that she was into kink, he was doing it.
Yeah.
But somebody online actually was like, by the way, why does the BDSM community get such a bad rap in these like cases? Even if you're into kink, no one's allowed to rape and hurt you. She definitely wasn't. Like, for avoidance of doubt, Nikki was not at all into this, and it was completely not consensual. And he was essentially trafficking her. We think he made like $5, but I think that counts. But nonetheless, even if somebody were into that kind of thing, you actually are not allowed to hurt them and rape them. So that was an interesting point somebody made.
Yeah, but we always do this thing of kind of like vague vibes with women of like she's a little bit nutty and she's a little bit slutty and like let's sprinkle some other seasoning of this on her and then like misogyny does the rest. We already have these scripts in our brains about women, and so it's super easy to activate them and then somehow justify whatever happens to them.
And by the way, it's like they would say about, oh, she just wanted attention. Well, yeah, I think maybe if somebody was trying to kill you, you might want a little bit
Yeah.
of attention. And yeah, like, is she unhinged? Well, I personally am a little unhinged myself, and I'm not being brutally like assaulted every day. So I don't even know what the two things have to do with each other. It's kind of like, Did he rape her or not? Whether or not she's a little bit wacky is really neither here nor there.
Right.
We of course paint her as that, even when she's not. But also, you can be a drug user. You can be have mental illness. You can have all these things, and it's still rape if you didn't, it's still abuse. Like, what does one thing have to do with another? Really?
Yeah, I mean, thank you for that. Like, it's so true. But we expect perfect victims, and then even when we get them, we just pretend that they're something that they're not, because women just, even though all of the data show us that women are victims, they're just not ever allowed to be victims.
Yeah, I think there's that saying. I think somebody said it's like, if the abuse was so bad, you should have left. And if you didn't leave, then it wasn't so bad.
Yeah. Well,
It's impossible.
I see that a lot with the women I work with who are often in violent relationships. And what happens is, if they leave, then the fact that they were able to leave and he didn't like immediately murder them
Yeah.
means that, she's lying.
Right.
And if they don't leave, then she's a bad mom and CPS is going to take custody of the kids. And I've even seen cases where the father molests the child. The mother reports the molestation and seeks help. And then over time, the mother is depicted as crazy for being with a child molester.
Oh
And
my God.
this ultimately leads to the child molester getting custody because at least he's not a crazy woman. And this is not like one person I'm talking about. This is like a replicable pattern that I've seen happen like many times.
So they just say he's not a child molester. That's their,
Sometimes it's like
or they say
hard to
he
know.
is, and it's okay because she it's better that
Sometimes, yeah, that's it. It's like, well, she allowed it, and maybe if he weren't with someone who allowed child molestation, it wouldn't happen. Sometimes it's more like, well, he's been caught now and we've talked to him, so he'll probably stop,
as molesters always do.
as molesters are known to do. And sometimes there's like not really any coherent story. And I think that's the most common situation. It's just like, we don't believe her that the molestation happened, but also she's an unfit mother because the molestation happened.
And she seems a little frantic. Let's have her
Yeah.
calm down,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah. She seems,
She's a little worked up. She's a little
yeah.
worked up, ma'am. Calm down. And you're
Just
like, my
calm
6-year-old's
down.
being raped. It's like, ma'am, calm down. Okay, she's
Yeah.
really unfit. Yeah, I mean, as you know, Tanisha had said, there's a once at one point she said she was running from the police. She was running from this abuser. She was hiding from everyone. She was hiding from herself. She was dipping in and out of her children's lives. She didn't know, she couldn't. She felt like her presence would make them unsafe. And she said, my people thought I was crazy. She said, well, I was. I was.
Yeah.
Because who wouldn't be in a complete state if you were put in these situations? So you're put in these situations. It makes you completely, I mean, you're not a common, like, collected person because your child is being molested or because you just witnessed a murder or because you've been relentlessly abused. And then your very human reaction to what you've endured is used to prove that, like, there's something wrong with you, and so probably everything you're saying you endured didn't really happen. I
Yeah.
mean, it's an upside down world. That's what I always call it. But I do have a theory, that, and I write about this in the book, that there's a whole purpose for this, because the existence of women like this, and probably some of the women you're talking about, because I think that what's important about this book and this topic is that we all exist on this spectrum. So some of us are much luckier than others, but we all do. The reason that this is done is that these women and what's going on with them really expose the failures of our systems. They expose how futile the carceral system is, how useless the criminal legal system is for women. They expose how, dangerous, I guess, in your case, these family courts can be to children. So if you believe them, then you have to understand all of these systems are either broken, is one way to put it, or functioning exactly as intended, which is to be cruel and punitive. And punish marginalized people. And if you accept that, that's a terrible thing. Like, how do you contend with the fact that there is no justice for these people? So we are really motivated to maintain the status quo by putting all of the individual responsibility on these particular women, painting them as bad and manipulative and, crazy. And if we can just officially say that that's their specific problem, then we don't have to contend with and confront the true problems at hand.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I was thinking about this while you were saying this, that I do think it's the system working as intended, and that a big part of the system is that women in these abusive situations have no out, because if women are dependent on and beholden to men, then men can just continuously extract resources from women. But in some ways, the explanation for why this happens, I don't think matters so much as just getting it to not happen anymore. So my question to you is, to people listening to this who are kind of new to these issues and want to do something, what do you recommend?
I wish I had some perfect answer because people have been asking me this a lot, since because I quite honestly believe it's like this giant systemic problem, and the book goes into how like the history of it, like how it's baked into our laws. But what I have seen work, or at least be a positive thing, is I watched like a TikTok algorithm delivered to me a video that was like the end and the hopeful end of every, leftist nonfiction book. And it was making fun of the fact that like the world is burning and you're just like mutual aid. But I will say, and it's like everything's terrible, but like community. But honestly, what I have seen, like with Nikki, for example, I have seen a community rise up around her. And it's not a spoiler, like she got free because of this. A community rally around her, like a, starting one person at a time, just to support her and to get her case known. And I've seen that really work. It didn't work right away. It's a long process. So I do think supporting one survivor who's incarcerated and trying to make, actions around them helps. There are organizations that do that. And on my website, justinevdl.com, there's a button called Free Tanisha. If you click on the Free Tanisha button, there's a list of good resources, which is organizations that do this work. And if people live in those particular states, they might be interested in those. I have ways to work on Tanisha's freedom, which I think is something that's a goal of mine for people to connect with her and to support her. And then, not that I think that individuals can necessarily do that, but I will say that even if we say the system is disastrous, nonetheless, reforms do help people. And there are these survivor justice laws in different states that are actually becoming more and more popular and are oddly bipartisan, like in Oklahoma and Louisiana. They're sponsored and supported by Trump, like MAGA Republicans as well. So these Survivor Justice Acts, they'll allow once they get into legend, once they get written into law, and there are some in different states, those allow for people going through the system to have their abuse considered when in sentencing, so that they can sentence them potentially to alternatives or to lesser time. Is also retroactive, and that's so important because women who are on the inside, people who are on the survivors, have no apertures to get out, no little opening, no little legal anything. So they're also retroactive. So anyone who has that case from a long time ago even can try to get their case heard again. So supporting those laws, I mean, that is a very vague thing, but they really are the kind of thing that helps. And then I just think narrative and awareness. I mean, I really obviously, I'm biased, but I really believe in the power of knowing the stories, understanding them, and I do think that can create a wellspring of renewed awareness and support, and people in power who pretend that they don't care what people think and feel, or pretend that they do but don't do anything about it. I think they really do respond to sort of cultural shifts as to what's acceptable and what's not, even if for just self-serving reasons like getting reelected.
I mean, I think we definitely see those shifts even in a really dark time, how it's become much less normalized that we just put people in prison forever, and it's become much less accepted that like the police and prisons can do whatever they want. So I think folks like you are playing a big role in that, and I'm just grateful that you're out there doing what you do, and I'm really excited about your book, and I hope it does awesome.
Thank you so much.
So thank you for coming on.
It was a great conversation. I love talking to you and your community that you've built.
Awesome. Well, listeners, I hope you'll order Justine's book and please leave great reviews for it and tell people about it. I just have to say that the way we show publishers that we want more feminist books and more books about women and more books about justice is to buy those books and show that they're valuable. So thank you so much for listening. Go buy Justine's book, and I will be back next week.